No said they'd get us both. Billy, the Abaskias can't get anyone. Fabrizio's dead, his brother's in a mental asylum where he thinks he's Napoleon or someone, and the rest are in jail. Hodges just gives him the look. Okay, Pete says. So you never catch all the cockroaches, but it's still crazy. All due respect, pal, but you're just a retired flatfoot out to pasture. Right. Which means they could go after me without creating a firestorm. You, on the other hand, still have a gold shield pinned to your wallet.
The idea's ridiculous, Isabel says, and folds her arms beneath her breasts as if to say that ends the matter.
Hodges shrugs. Somebody tried to blow me up, and I can't believe the Mercedes killer somehow got an ESP vibe that I was looking into the case of the missing key. Even if he did, why would he come after me? How could that lead to him?
Well, he's crazy, Pete says. How about that for a start?
Sure, but I repeat, how would he know?
No idea. Listen, Billy, are you holding anything back? Anything at all?
No.
I think you are, Isabel says. She cocks her head. Hey, you weren't sleeping with her, were you?
Hodges shifts his gaze to her. What do you think, Izzy? Look at me.
She holds his eyes for a moment, then drops them.
Hodges can't believe how close she just came. Women's intuition, he thinks, and then, probably a good thing I haven't lost any more weight or put that just for men shit in my hair. Look, Pete, I want to shake, go home and have a beer and try to get my head around this.
You swear you're not holding anything back? This is you and me now.
Hodges passes up his last chance to come clean without a qualm. Not a thing. Pete tells him to stay in touch. They'll want him in tomorrow or Friday for a formal statement. Not a problem. And Pete, in the immediate future, I'd give my car a once-over before driving it if I were you. At the door, Pete puts an arm over Hodges' shoulders and gives him a hug.
I'm sorry about this, he says. Sorry about what happened and about all the questions.
It's okay. You're doing the job.
Pete tightens his grip and whispers in Hodges' ear,
You are holding back. You think I've been taking stupid pills? For a moment, Hodges rethinks his options. Then he remembers Janie saying, He's ours. He takes Pete by the arms, looks him full in the face, and says, I'm just as mystified about this as you are. Trust me.
25.
Hodges crosses the detective division bullpen, fielding the curious glances and leading questions with a stone face that only breaks once. Cassie Sheen, with whom he worked most often when Pete was on vacation, says, Look at you, still alive and uglier than ever. He smiles. If it isn't Cassie Sheen, the Botox queen. He lifts an arm in mock defense when she picks a paperweight up off her desk and brandishes it. It all feels both fake and real at the same time, like one of those girl fights on afternoon TV. In the hall, there's a line of chairs near the snack and soda machines. Sitting in two of the chairs are Aunt Charlotte and Uncle Henry. Holly isn't with them, and Hodges instinctively touches the glasses case in his pants pocket. He asks Uncle Henry if he's feeling better. Uncle Henry says he is, and thanks him. He turns to Aunt Charlotte and asks how she's doing.
I'm fine. It's Holly I'm worried about. I think she blames herself, because she's the reason. You know.
Hodges knows. The reason Janie was driving his car. Of course, Janie would have been in it anyway, but he doubts if that changes the way Holly feels.
I wish you'd talk to her. You bonded with her, somehow.
Her eyes take on an unpleasant gleam.
The way you bonded with Janelle. You must have a way about you.
I'll do that, Hodges says, and he will. But Jerome is going to talk to her first. Assuming the number on the glasses case works, that is. For all he knows, that number rings a landline in, where was it? Cincinnati? Cleveland?
I hope we're not supposed to identify her,
Uncle Henry says. In one hand, he holds a styrofoam cup of coffee. He's hardly touched it, and Hodges isn't surprised. The police department coffee is notorious.
How can we? She was blown to bits.
Don't be an idiot, Aunt Charlotte says.
They don't want us to do that. They can't.
Hodges says, if she's ever been fingerprinted, most people have, they'll do it that way. They may show you photographs of her clothes or personal pieces of jewelry.
How would we know about her jewelry? Aunt Charlotte cries.
A cop getting a soda turns to look at her.
And I hardly noticed what she was wearing.
Hodges guesses she priced out every stitch but doesn't comment. They may have other questions. Some about him. It shouldn't take long. There's an elevator, but Hodges chooses the stairs. On the landing, one flight down, he leans against the wall, eyes closed, and takes half a dozen big shuddering breaths. The tears come now. He swipes them away with his sleeve. Aunt Charlotte expressed concern about Holly, a concern Hodges shares, but no sorrow about her blown-to-bits niece. He guesses that Aunt Charlotte's biggest interest in Janie right now is what happens to all the lovely dosh Janie inherited from her sister. I hope she left it to a fucking dog hospital, he thinks. Hodges sits down with an out-of-breath grunt. Using one of the stairs as a makeshift desk, he lays out the sunglasses case, and from his wallet, a creased sheet of notepaper with two sets of numbers on it. 26.
Hello? The voice is soft, tentative. Hello? Who is this?
My name's Jerome Robinson, ma'am. I believe Bill Hodges said I might call you. Silence. Ma'am? Jerome is sitting by his computer, holding his android almost tightly enough to crack the casing. Ms. Gibney?
I'm here.
It's almost a sigh.
He said he wants to catch the person who killed my cousin. There was a terrible explosion.
I know, Jerome says. Down the hall, Barb starts playing her new Round Here record for the 1,000th time. Kisses on the Midway, it's called. It hasn't driven him crazy yet, but crazy gets closer with every play. Meanwhile, the woman on the other end of the line has started to cry. Ma'am?
Ms. Gibney? I'm very sorry for your loss. I hardly knew her, but she was my cousin, and she was nice to me. So was Mr. Hodges. Do you know what he asked me?
No. Uh-uh.
If I'd eaten breakfast. Wasn't that considerate?
It sure was, Jerome says. He still can't believe the lively, vital lady he had dinner with is dead. He remembers how her eyes sparkled when she laughed, and how she mocked Bill's way of saying yeah. Now he's on the phone with a woman he's never met, a very odd woman from the sound of her. Talking to her feels like defusing a bomb. Ma'am, Bill asked me to come out there.
Will he come with you?
He can't right now. He's got other things he has to do. There's more silence, and then, in a voice so low and timid he can barely hear it, Holly asks,
Are you safe? Because I worry about people, you know. I worry very much.
Yes, ma'am, I'm safe.
I want to help Mr. Hodges. I want to help catch the man who did it. He must be crazy, don't you think?
Yes, Jerome says. Down the hall, another song starts, and two little girls, Barbara and her friend Hilda, emit joyous shrieks almost high enough to shatter glass. He thinks of 3,000 or 4,000 Barbs and Hildas all shrieking in unison tomorrow night, and thanks God his mother is pulling that duty.
You could come, but I don't know how to let you in, she says. My Uncle Henry set the burglar alarm when he went out, and I don't know the code. I think he shut the gate, too.
I've got all that covered, Jerome says.
When will you come?
I can be there in half an hour.
If you talk to Mr. Hodges, will you tell him something for me?
Sure.
Tell him I'm sad, too. She pauses. And that I'm taking my Lexapro.
27. Late that Wednesday afternoon, Brady checks into a gigantic Motel 6 near the airport using one of his Ralph Jones credit cards. He has a suitcase and a knapsack. In the knapsack is a single change of clothes, which is all he'll need for the few dozen hours of life that still remain to him. In the suitcase is the ass parking cushion, the Uranesta pee bag, a framed picture, several homemade detonator switches. He only expects to need one, but you can never have enough backup. Thing two, several Glad storage bags filled with ball bearings, and enough homemade explosive to blow both the motel and the adjacent parking lot sky high. He goes back to his Subaru, pulls out a larger item, with some effort, it barely fits, carries it into his room, and leans it against the wall. He lies down on his bed. His head feels strange against the pillow. Naked, and sort of sexy, somehow. He thinks, I've had a run of bad luck, but I've ridden it out, and I'm still standing. He closes his eyes. Soon he's snoring. 28. Jerome parks his Wrangler with the nose almost touching the closed gate at 729 Lilac Drive, gets out, and pushes the call button. He has a reason to be here if someone from the Sugar Heights Security Patrol should stop and query him, but it will only work if the woman inside confirms him, and he's not sure he can count on that. His earlier conversation with the lady has suggested that she's got one wheel on the road at most. In any case, he's not challenged, and after a moment or two of standing there and trying to look as if he belongs, this is one of those occasions when he feels especially black, Holly answers.
Yes? Who is it?
Jerome, Miss Gibney. Bill Hodges' friend? A pause so long he's about to push the button again when she says,
You have the gate code?
Yes.
All right. And if you're a friend of Mr. Hodges, I guess you can call me Holly.
He pushes the code, and the gate opens. He drives through and watches it close behind him. So far, so good. Holly is at the front door, peering at him through one of the side windows like a prisoner in a high-security visitation area. She's wearing a house coat over pajamas and her hair is a mess. A brief nightmare scenario crosses Jerome's mind. She pushes the panic button on the burglar alarm panel, almost certainly right next to where she's standing, and when the security guys arrive, she accuses him of being a burglar, or a would-be rapist with a flannel pajama fetish. The door is locked. He points to it. For a moment, Holly just stands there like a robot with a dead battery. Then she turns the deadbolt. A shrill peeping sound commences when Jerome opens the door, and she takes several steps backward, covering her mouth with both hands.
Don't let me get in trouble. I don't want to get in trouble.
She's twice as nervous as he is, and this eases Jerome's mind. He punches the code into the burglar alarm and hits all secure. The peeping stops. Holly collapses into an ornately carved chair that looks like it might have cost enough to pay for a year at a good college, although maybe not Harvard, her hair hanging around her face in dank wings.
Oh, this has been the worst day of my life, she says. Poor Janie. Poor, poor Janie.
I'm sorry.
But at least it's not my fault.
She looks up at him with thin and pitiable defiance.
No one can say it was. I didn't do anything.
Of course you didn't, Jerome says. It comes out sounding stilted, but she smiles a little, so maybe it's okay.
Is Mr. Hodges all right? He's a very, very, very nice man, even though my mother doesn't like him.
She shrugs.
But who does she like?
He's fine, Jerome says, although he doubts if that's true.
You're black,
she says, looking at him wide-eyed. Jerome looks down at his hands. I am, aren't I? She bursts into peals of shrill laughter.
I'm sorry, that was rude. It's fine that you're black.
Black is whack, Jerome says.
Of course it is totally whack.
She stands up, gnaws at her lower lip, then pistons out her hand with an obvious effort of will.
Put it there, Jerome.
He shakes. Her hand is clammy. It's like shaking the paw of a small and timid animal.
We have to hurry. If my mother and Uncle Henry come back and catch you in here, I'm in trouble.
You, Jerome thinks. What about the black kid? The woman who used to live here was also your cousin, right?
Yes, Olivia Trelawney, I haven't seen her since I was in college. She and my mother never got along.
She looks at him solemnly.
I had to drop out of college. I had issues.
Jerome bets she did, and does. Still, there's something about her he likes. God knows what. It's surely not that fingernails on a blackboard laugh. Do you know where her computer is?
Yes, I'll show you. Can you be quick?
I better be, Jerome thinks.
29. The late Olivia Trelawney's computer is password protected, which is silly because when he turns over the keyboard, he finds O-T-R-E-L-A-W written there with a Sharpie. Holly, standing in the doorway and flipping the collar of her housecoat nervously up and down, mutters something he doesn't catch. Huh?
I asked what you're looking for.
You'll know it if I find it. He opens the finder and types, crying baby, into the search field. No result. He tries weeping infant. Nothing. He tries screaming woman. Nothing.
It could be hidden.
This time he hears her clearly because her voice is right next to his ear. He jumps a little, but Holly doesn't notice. She's bent over with her hands on her house-coated knees, staring at Olivia's monitor.
Try audio file.
That's a pretty good idea, so he does. But there's nothing.
Okay, she says. Go to System Preferences and look at sound.
Holly, all that does is control the input and output, stuff like that.
Well, duh. Try it anyway.
She stopped biting her lips. Jerome does. Under output, the menu lists sound sticks, headphones, and log me in sound driver. Under input, there's internal microphone and line in, nothing he didn't expect. Any other ideas? He asks her.
Open sound effects, over there on the left.
He turns to her. Hey, you know this stuff, don't you?
I took a computer course from home, on Skype. It was interesting. Go on, look at sound effects.
Jerome does, and blinks at what he sees. In addition to frog, glass, ping, pop, and purr, the usual suspects, there's an item listed as spooks. Never seen that one before.
Me either.
She still won't look directly at his face, but her affect has changed remarkably otherwise. She pulls up a chair and sits beside him, tucking her lank hair behind her ears.
And I know Mac programs inside and out.
Go with your bad self, Jerome says and holds up a hand. Still looking at the screen, Holly slaps him 5.
Play it, Sam.
He grins. Casablanca.
Yes. I've seen that movie 73 times. I have a movie book. I write down everything I see. My mother says that's OCD.
Life is OCD, Jerome says. Unsmiling, Holly replies,
go with your bad self.
Jerome highlights spooks and bangs the return key. From the stereo sound sticks on either side of Olivia's computer, a baby begins to wail. Holly is okay with that. She doesn't clutch Jerome's shoulder until the woman shrieks,
why did you let him murder my baby?
Fuck! Jerome cries and grabs Holly's hand. He doesn't even think about it, and she doesn't draw away. They stare at the computer as if it has grown teeth and bitten them. There's a moment of silence. Then the baby starts crying again. The woman screams again. The program cycles a third time, then stops. Holly finally looks directly at him, her eyes so wide they seem in danger of falling out of her head.
Did you know that was going to happen?
Jesus, no. Maybe something or Bill wouldn't have sent him here, but that? Can you find out anything about the program, Holly? Like when it was installed? If you can't, that's all right.
Push over.
Jerome is good with computers, but Holly plays the keyboard like a Steinway. After a few minutes of hunting around, she says,
looks like it was installed on July 1st of last year. A whole bunch of stuff was installed that day.
It could have been programmed to play at certain times, right? Cycle 3 times and then quit? She gives him an impatient glance.
Of course.
Then how come it's not still playing? I mean, you guys have been staying here. You would have heard it. She clicks the mouse like crazy and shows him something else.
I saw this already. It's a slave program hidden in her mail contacts. I bet Olivia didn't know it was here. It's called Looking Glass. You can't use it to turn on a computer. At least I don't think so. But if it is on, you can run everything from your own computer. Open files, read emails, look at search histories, or deactivate programs.
Like after she was dead, Jerome says.
Oof,
Holly grimaces. Why would the guy who installed this leave it? Why not erase it completely?
I don't know. Maybe he just forgot. I forget stuff all the time. My mother says I'd forget my own head if it wasn't attached to my neck.
Yeah, mine says that too. But who's he? Who are we talking about? She thinks it over. They both do. And after perhaps 5 seconds, they speak at the same time. Her IT guy, Jerome says, just as Holly says,
her geek freak.
Jerome starts going through the drawers of Olivia's computer station, looking for a computer service invoice, a bill stamped paid, or a business card. There ought to be at least one of those, but there's nothing. He gets on his knees and crawls into the knee hole under the desk. Nothing there either. Look on the fridge, he says. Sometimes people put shit there under little magnets.
There are plenty of magnets, Holly says, but nothing on the fridge except for a real estate agent's card and one from the Vigilant Security Company. I think Janie must have taken down everything else, probably threw it away.
Is there a safe?
Probably, but why would my cousin put her IT guy's business card in her safe? It's not like it's worth money or anything.
True that, Jerome says.
If it was here, it would be by her computer. She wouldn't hide it. I mean, she wrote her password right under her gosh darn keyboard.
Pretty dumb, Jerome says.
Totally.
Holly suddenly seems to realize how close they are. She gets up and goes back to the doorway. She starts flipping the collar of her house coat again.
What are you going to do now?
I guess I better call Bill. He takes out his cell phone, but before he can make the call, she says his name. Jerome looks at her, standing there in the doorway, looking lost in her flappy comfort clothes.
There must be, like, a zillion IT guys in this city, she says.
Nowhere near that many, but a lot. He knows it, and Hodges knows it too, because it was Jerome who told him. 30. Hodges listens carefully to everything Jerome has to say. He's pleased by Jerome's praise of Holly and hopes Holly will be pleased too if she's listening, but bitterly disappointed that there's no link to the computer jack who worked on Olivia's machine. Jerome thinks it must be because Janie threw computer jack's business card away. Hodges, who has a mind trained to be suspicious, thinks Mr. Mercedes might have made damn sure Olivia didn't have a card. Only that doesn't track. Wouldn't you ask for one if the guy did good work and keep it handy? Unless, that is, he asks Jerome to put Holly on.
Hello?
So faint he has to strain to hear. Holly, is there an address book on Olivia's computer?
Just a minute.
He hears faint clicking. When she comes back, her voice is puzzled.
No.
Does that strike you as weird?
Kinda, yeah.
Could the guy who planted the spook sounds have deleted her address book?
Oh, sure. Easy. I'm taking my Lexapro, Mr. Hodges.
That's great, Holly. Can you tell how much Olivia used her computer?
Sure.
Let me talk to Jerome while you look. Jerome comes on and says he's sorry they haven't been able to find more. No, no, you've done great. When you tossed her desk, you didn't find a physical address book. But lots of people don't bother with them anymore. They keep all their contacts on their computers and phones. You know that, right? Hodges supposes he should know it, but the world is moving too fast for him these days. He doesn't even know how to program his DVR. Hang on, Holly wants to talk to you again. You and Holly are getting along pretty well, huh?
We're cool. Here she is. Olivia had all kinds of programs and website faves, Holly says. She was big on Hulu and HuffPo, and her search history. It looks to me like she spent even more time browsing than I do, and I'm online a lot.
Holly, why would a person who really depends on her computer not have a service card handy?
Because the guy snuck in and took it after she was dead, Holly says promptly.
Maybe, but think of the risk, especially with the neighborhood security service keeping an eye on things. He'd have to know the gate code, the burglar alarm code, and even then he'd need a house key. He trails off.
Mr. Hodges, are you still there?
Yes, and go ahead and call me Bill. But she won't. Maybe she can't.
Mr. Hodges, is he a master criminal, like in James Bond?
I think just crazy. And because he's crazy, the risk might not matter to him. Look at the risk he took at City Center plowing into that crowd of people. It still doesn't ring right. Give me Jerome again, will you? She does, and Hodges tells him it's time to get out before Aunt Charlotte and Uncle Henry come back and catch him computer canoodling with Holly.
What are you going to do, Bill?
He looks out at the street where twilight has started to deepen the colors of the day. It's close to 7 o'clock. Sleep on it, he says. 31. Before going to bed, Hodges spends 4 hours in front of the TV, watching shows that go in his eyes just fine but disintegrate before reaching his brain. He tries to think about nothing, because that's how you open the door so the right idea can come in. The right idea always arrives as a result of the right connection, and there is a connection waiting to be made. He feels it. Maybe more than one. He will not let Janie into his thoughts. Later, yes, but for now all she can do is jam his gears. Olivia Trelawney's computer is the crux of the matter. It was rigged with spook sounds, and the most likely suspect is her IT guy. So why didn't she have his card? He could delete her computer address book at long distance, and Hodges is betting he did. But did he break into her house to steal a fucking business card after she was dead? He gets a call from a newspaper reporter, then from a Channel 6 guy. After the third call from someone in the media, Hodges shuts his phone down. He doesn't know who spilled his cell number, but he hopes the person was well paid for the info. Something else keeps coming into his mind. Something that has nothing to do with anything. She thinks they walk among us. A refresher glance through his notes allows him to put his finger on who said that to him. Mr. Bowfinger, the greeting card writer. He and Bowfinger were sitting in lawn chairs, and Hodges remembers being grateful for the shade. This was while he was doing his canvas, looking for anyone who might have seen a suspicious vehicle cruising the street. She thinks they walk among us. Bowfinger was talking about Mrs. Melbourne across the street. Mrs. Melbourne, who belongs to an organization of UFO nuts called NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Hodges decides it's just one of those echoes, like a snatch of pop music that can start resounding in an overstressed brain. He gets undressed and goes to bed, and Janie comes. Janie wrinkling her nose and saying, yeah. And for the first time since childhood, he actually cries himself to sleep. He wakes up in the small hours of Thursday morning, takes a leak, starts back to bed, and stops. Eyes widening. What he's been looking for, the connection, is suddenly there big as life. You didn't bother keeping a business card if you didn't need one. Say the guy wasn't an independent running a little business out of his house, but someone who worked for a company. If that was the case, you could call the company number any time you needed him because it would be something easy to remember, like 555-9999 or whatever the numbers were that spelled out compute. If he worked for a company, he'd make his repair calls in a company car. Hodges goes back to bed, sure that sleep will elude him this time, but it doesn't. He thinks, if he had enough explosive to blow up my car, he must have more. And then he's under again. He dreams about Janie.
Kisses on the Midway.
1. Hodges is up at 6 a.m. on Thursday morning and makes himself a big breakfast, 2 eggs, 4 slices of bacon, 4 slices of toast. He doesn't want it, but he forces himself to eat every bite, telling himself it's body gasoline. He might get a chance to eat again today, but he might not. Both in the shower and as he chews his way resolutely through his big breakfast, no one to watch his weight for now. A thought keeps recurring to him, the same one he went to sleep with the night before. It's like a haunting. Just how much explosive? This leads to other unpleasant considerations, like how the guy, the perk, means to use it, and when. He comes to a decision. Today is the last day. He wants to track Mr. Mercedes down himself and confront him. Kill him? No, not that. Probably not that. But beating the shit out of him would be excellent. For Olivia. For Janie. For Janice and Patricia Cray. For all the other people Mr. Mercedes killed and maimed at City Center the year before. People so desperate for jobs they got up in the middle of the night and stood waiting in a dank fog for the doors to open. Lost lives. Lost hopes. Lost souls. So yes, he wants the son of a bitch. But if he can't nail him today, he'll turn the whole thing over to Pete Huntley and Izzy Janes and take the consequences, which he knows may well lead to some jail time. It doesn't matter. He's got plenty on his conscience already, but he guesses it can bear a little more weight. Not another mass killing, though. That would destroy what little of him there is left. He decides to give himself until 8 o'clock tonight. That's the line in the sand. He can do as much in those 13 hours as Pete and Izzy, probably more because he's not constrained by routine or procedure. Today he will carry his father's M&P 38, and the happy slapper, that too. The slapper goes in the right front pocket of his sport coat, the revolver under his left arm. In his study, he grabs his Mr. Mercedes file, it's quite fat now, and takes it back to the kitchen. While he reads it through again, he uses the remote to fire up the TV on the counter and tunes in Morning at 7 on Channel 6. He's almost relieved to see that a crane has toppled over down by the lakeshore, half-sinking a barge filled with chemicals. He doesn't want the lake any more polluted than it already is, assuming that's possible, but the spill has pushed the car bomb story back to second place. That's the good news. The bad is that he's identified as the detective now retired who was the lead investigator of the City Center Massacre Task Force, and the woman killed in the car bombing is identified as Olivia Trelawney's sister. There's a still photo of him and Janie standing outside the Soames funeral home taken by God knows who. Police are not saying if there's a connection to last year's mass killing at City Center, the newscaster says gravely. But it's worth noting that the perpetrator of that crime has as yet not been caught. In other crime news, Donald Davis is expected to be arraigned. Hodges no longer gives shit one about Donald Davis. He kills the TV and returns to the notes on his yellow legal pad. He's still going through them when his phone rings. Not the cell, although today he's carrying it, but the one on the wall. It's Pete Huntley. "You're up with the birdies," Pete says. "Good detective work. How can I help you?" "We had an interesting interview yesterday with Henry Seroy and Charlotte Gibney. You know Janelle Patterson's aunt and uncle?" Hodges waits for it. "The aunt was especially fascinating. She thinks Izzy was right and you and Patterson were a lot more than just acquaintances. She thinks you were very good friends." "Say what you mean, Pete."
"Making the beast with two backs. Laying some pipe. Slicing a cake, hiding a salami, doing the horizontal book."
"I think I get it. Let me tell you something about Aunt Charlotte, okay? If she saw a photo of Justin Bieber talking to Queen Elizabeth, she'd tell you the Beeb was tapping her. Just look at their eyes," she'd say.
"So you weren't?"
"No."
"I'll take that on a tryout basis, mostly for old time's sake, but I still want to know what you're hiding, because this stinks."
"Read my lips. Not hiding anything."
Silence from the other end. Pete is waiting for Hodges to grow uncomfortable and break it, for the moment forgetting who taught him that trick. At last he gives up.
I think you're digging yourself a hole, Billy. My advice is to drop the shovel before you're in too deep to climb out.
Thanks, partner. Always good to get life lessons at 7:15 in the morning.
I want to interview you again this afternoon, and this time I may have to read you the words.
The Miranda warning is what he means. Happy to make that work. Call me on my cell.
Really? Since you retired, you never carry it.
I'm carrying it today. Yes, indeed. Because for the next 12 or 14 hours, he's totally unretired. He ends the call and goes back to his notes, wetting the tip of his index finger each time he turns a page. He circles a name. Radney Peoples. The vigilant guard service guy he talked to out in Sugar Heights. If Peoples is even halfway doing his job, he may hold the key to Mr. Mercedes. But there's no chance he won't remember Hodges, not after Hodges first braced him for his company ID and then questioned him. And he'll know that today Hodges is big news. There's time to think about how to solve the problem. Hodges doesn't want to call Vigilant until regular business hours, because the call has to look like ordinary routine. The next call he receives, on his cell this time, is from Aunt Charlotte. Hodges isn't surprised to hear from her, but that doesn't mean he's pleased.
I don't know what to do, she cries. You have to help me, Mr. Hodges.
Don't know what to do about what?
The body. Janelle's body. I don't even know where it is.
Hodges gets a beep and checks the incoming number. Mrs. Gibney, I have another call and I have to take it.
I don't see why you can't.
Janie's not going anywhere, so just stand by. I'll call you back. He cuts her off in the middle of a protesting squawk and goes to Jerome.
I thought you might need a chauffeur today, Jerome says, considering your current situation.
For a moment, Hodges doesn't know what the kid is talking about, then remembers that his Toyota has been reduced to charred fragments. What remains of it is now in the custody of the PD's forensics department, where later today men in white coats will be going over it to determine what kind of explosive was used to blow it up. He got home last night in a taxi. He will need a ride, and he realizes Jerome may be useful in another way. That would be good, he says. But what about school?
I'm carrying a 3.9 average, Jerome says patiently. I'm also working for Citizens United and team teaching a computer class for disadvantaged kids. I can afford to skip a day, and I already cleared it with my mom and dad. They just asked me to ask you if anyone else was going to try to blow you up.
Actually, that's not out of the question.
Hang on a second. Faintly, Hodges hears Jerome calling. He says no one will.
In spite of everything, Hodges has to smile.
I'll be there double quick, Jerome says.
Don't break any speed laws. 9 o'clock will be fine. Use the time to practice your thespian skills.
Really? What role am I thesping?
Law office paralegal, Hodges says. And thanks, Jerome. He breaks the connection, goes into his study, boots up his computer, and searches for a local lawyer named Schron. It's an unusual name, and he finds it with no trouble. He notes down the firm and Schron's first name, which happens to be George. Then he returns to the kitchen and calls Aunt Charlotte. Hodges, he says, back at you.
I don't appreciate being hung up on, Mr. Hodges.
No more than I appreciate you telling my old partner that I was fucking your niece. He hears a shocked gasp, followed by silence. He almost hopes she'll hang up. When she doesn't, he tells her what she needs to know. Janie's remains will be at the Huron County Morgue. You won't be able to take possession today, probably not tomorrow either. There'll have to be an autopsy, which is absurd given the cause of death, but it's protocol.
You don't understand. I have plane reservations.
Hodges looks out his kitchen window and counts slowly to 5.
Mr. Hodges, are you still there?
As I see it, you have 2 choices, Mrs. Gibney. One is to stay here and do the right thing. The other is to use your reservation, fly home, and let the city do it. Aunt Charlotte begins to snivel.
I saw the way you were looking at her, and the way she was looking at you. All I did was answer the woman cop's questions.
And with great alacrity, I have no doubt.
With what?
He sighs. Let's drop it. I suggest you and your brother visit the county morgue in person. Don't call ahead, let them see your faces. Talk to Dr. Galworthy.
If Galworthy's not there, talk to Dr. Patel. If you ask them in person to expedite matters, and if you can manage to be nice about it, they'll give you as much help as they can. Use my name. I go back to the early 90s with both of them.
We'd have to leave Holly again,
Aunt Charlotte says.
She's locked herself in her room. She's clicking away on her laptop and won't come out.
Hodges discovers he's pulling his hair and makes himself stop. How old is your daughter?
A long pause. 45.
Then you can probably get away with not hiring a sitter. He tries to suppress what comes next and can't quite manage it. Think of the money you'll save.
I can hardly expect you to understand Holly's situation, Mr. Hodges. As well as being mentally unstable, my daughter is very sensitive.
Hodges thinks that must make you especially difficult for her. This time he manages not to say it.
Mr. Hodges.
Still here.
You don't happen to know if Janelle left a will, do you?
He hangs up.
2. Brady spends a long time in the motel shower with the lights off. He likes the womb-like warmth and the steady drumming sound. He also likes the darkness, and it's good that he does because soon he'll have all he ever wanted. He'd like to believe there's going to be a tender mother and child reunion, perhaps even one of the mother and lover type, but in his heart, he doesn't. He can pretend, but no. Just darkness. He's not worried about God, or about spending eternity being slow-roasted for his crimes. There's no heaven and no hell. Anyone with half a brain knows those things don't exist. How cruel would a supreme being have to be to make a world as fucked up as this one? Even if the vengeful God of the televangelists and child-molesting black robes did exist, how could that thunderbolt thrower possibly blame Brady for the things he's done? Did Brady Hartsfield grab his father's hand and wrap it around the live power line that electrocuted him? No. Did he shove that apple slice down Frankie's throat? No. Was he the one who talked on and on about how the money was going to run out and they'd end up living in a homeless shelter? No. Did he cook up a poison hamburger and say, "Eat this, Ma, it's delicious"? Can he be blamed for striking out at the world that has made him what he is? Brady thinks not. He muses on the terrorists who brought down the World Trade Center. He muses on them often. Those clowns actually thought they were going to paradise, where they'd live in a kind of eternal luxury hotel being serviced by gorgeous young virgins. Pretty funny, and the best part? The joke was on them. Not that they knew it. What they got was a momentary view of all those windows and a final flash of light. After that, they and their thousands of victims were just gone. Poof. See you later, alligator. Off you go, killers and killed alike. Off you go into the universal null set that surrounds one lonely blue planet and all its mindlessly bustling denizens. Every religion lies. Every moral precept is a delusion. Even the stars are a mirage. The truth is darkness, and the only thing that matters is making a statement before one enters it. Cutting the skin of the world and leaving a scar. That's all history is, after all. Scar tissue.
3.
Brady dresses and drives to a 24-hour drugstore near the airport. He's seen in the bathroom mirror that his mother's electric razor left a lot to be desired. His skull needs more maintenance. He gets disposable razors and shaving cream. He grabs more batteries because you can never have enough. He also picks up a pair of clear glass spectacles from a spinner rack. He chooses horn rims because they give him a studently look, or so it seems to him. On his way to the checkout, he stops at a cardboard stand-up display featuring the four clean-cut boys in round here. The copy reads, "Get your gear on for the big show, June 3rd," only someone has crossed out June 3rd and written "tonight" below it. Although Brady usually takes an M t-shirt, he's always been slim, he picks out an XL and adds it to the rest of his swag. No need to stand in line. This early, he's the only customer. Going to the show tonight?
The checkout girl asks. Brady gives her a big grin.
I sure am.
On his way back to the motel, Brady starts to think about his car. To worry about his car. The Ralph Jones alias is all very fine, but the Subaru is registered to Brady Hartsfield. If the debt ret discovers his name and tells 5-0, that could be a problem. The motel is safe enough. They no longer ask for plate numbers, just a driver's license. But the car is not... The debt ret's not close, Brady tells himself. He was just trying to freak you out. Except maybe not. This particular debt solved a lot of cases before he was ret, and some of those skills still seem to be there. Instead of going directly back to the Motel 6, Brady swings into the airport, takes a ticket, and leaves the Subaru in long-term parking. He'll need it tonight, but for now it's fine where it is. He glances at his watch. 10 to 9. 11 hours until the showtime, he thinks. Maybe 12 hours until the darkness. Could be less, could be more, but not much more. He puts on his new glasses and carries his purchases the half mile back to the motel, whistling. 4. When Hodges opens his front door, the first thing Jerome keys on is the .38 in the shoulder rig.
You're not going to shoot anyone with that, are you?
I doubt it. Think of it as a good luck charm. It was my father's, and I have a permit to carry concealed if that was on your mind.
What's on my mind, Jerome says, is whether or not it's loaded.
Of course it is. What did you think I was going to do if I did have to use it? Throw it? Jerome sighs and ruffles his cap of dark hair.
This is getting heavy.
One out? If you do, your taillights. Right this minute. I can still rent a car.
No, I'm good. It's you I'm wondering about. Those aren't bags under your eyes, they're suitcases.
I'll be okay. Today is it for me, anyway. If I can't track this guy down by nightfall, I'm going to see my old partner and tell him everything.
How much trouble will you be in?
Don't know, no much care.
How much trouble will I be in?
None. If I couldn't guarantee that, you'd be in period one algebra right now. Jerome gives him a pitying look.
Algebra was 4 years ago. Tell me what I can do.
Hodges does so. Jerome is willing, but doubtful.
Last month, you can't ever tell my folks this, a bunch of us tried to get into Punch and Judy, that new dance club downtown. The guy at the door didn't even look at my beautiful fake ID, just waved me out of the line and told me to go get a milkshake.
Hodges says, I'm not surprised. Your face is 17, but fortunately for me, your voice is at least 25. He slides Jerome a piece of paper with a phone number written on it. Make the call. Jerome tells the Vigilant Guard Service receptionist who answers that he is Martin Lounsbury, a paralegal at the firm of Canton, Silver, Makepeace, and Jackson. He says he is currently working with George Schron, a junior partner assigned to tie up a few loose ends concerning the estate of the late Olivia Trelawney. One of those loose ends has to do with Mrs. Trelawney's computer. His job for the day is to locate the IT specialist who worked on the machine. And it seems possible that one of the vigilant employees in the Sugar Heights area may be able to help him locate the gentleman. Hodges makes a thumb and forefinger circle to indicate Jerome is doing well and passes him a note.
Jerome reads it and says, One of Mrs. Trelawney's neighbors, Mrs. Helen Wilcox, mentioned a Rodney Peoples?
He listens, then nods.
Radney. I see. What an interesting name. Perhaps he could call me if it's not too much trouble. My boss is a bit of a tyrant, and I'm really under the gun here.
He listens.
Yes? Oh, that's great. Thanks so much. He gives the receptionist the numbers of his cell and Hodges' landline, then hangs up and wipes make-believe sweat from his forehead.
I'm glad that's over. Whew! You did fine, Hodges assures him. What if she calls Canton, Silver, and Hoosus to check, and finds out they never heard of Martin Lounsbury? Her job is to pass messages on, not investigate them.
What if the people's guy checks?
Hodges doesn't think he will. He thinks the name Helen Wilcox will stop him. When he talked to Peoples that day outside the Sugar Heights mansion, Hodges caught a strong vibe that Peoples' relationship with Helen Wilcox was more than just platonic. Maybe a little more, maybe a lot. He thinks Peoples will give Martin Lounsbury what he wants so he'll go away.
What do we do now? Jerome asks.
What they do is something Hodges spent at least half his career doing. Wait.
How long?
Until Peoples or some other security grunt calls. Because right now, Vigilant Guard Service is looking like his best lead. If it doesn't pan out, they'll have to go out to Sugar Heights and start interviewing neighbors, not a prospect he relishes given his current news cycle celebrity.
In the meantime, he finds himself thinking again of Mr. Bowfinger and Mrs. Melbourne, the slightly crackers woman who lives across the street from him. With her talk about mysterious black SUVs and her interest in flying saucers, Mrs. Melbourne could have been a quirky supporting character in an old Alfred Hitchcock movie.
She thinks they walk among us, Bowfinger had said, giving his eyebrows a satirical wiggle. And why in God's name should that keep bouncing around in Hodge's head?
It's 10 of 10 when Jerome's cell rings.
The little snatch of AC/DC's Hell's Bells makes them both jump. Jerome grabs it.
It says, call blocked. What should I do, Bill?
Take it. It's him. And remember who you are.
Jerome opens the line and says, hello, this is Martin Lounsbury. Listens. Oh, hello, Mr. Peoples. Thanks so much for getting back to me.
Hodges scribbles a fresh note and pushes it across the table. Jerome scans it quickly.
Aha. Yes. Mrs. Wilcox speaks very highly of you. Very highly indeed. But my job has to do with the late Mrs. Trelawney. We can't finish clearing her estate until we can inventory her computer and... Yes, I know it's been over 6 months. Terrible how slowly these things move, isn't it? We had a client last year who actually had to apply for food stamps even though he had a $70,000 bequest pending.
Don't over-butter the muffin, Jerome, Hodges thinks. His heart is hammering in his chest.
No, it's nothing like that. I just need the name of the fellow who worked on it for her. The rest is up to my boss.
Jerome listens, eyebrows pulling together.
You can't. Oh, that's a shame.
But Peoples is talking again. The sweat on Jerome's brow is no longer imaginary. He reaches across the table, grabs Hodges' pen, and begins to scribble.
While he writes, he keeps up a steady stream of uh-huhs and okays and I-sees. Finally, hey, that's great. Totally great. I'm sure Mr. Shrine can roll with this. You've been a big help, Mr. Peoples. So I'll just...
He listens some more.
Yes, it's a terrible thing. I believe Mr. Shrine is dealing with some aspects of that even as we speak, but I really don't know anything.
You did? Wow.
Mr. Peoples, you've been great. Yes, I'll mention that. I certainly will. Thanks, Mr. Peoples.
He breaks the connection and puts the heels of his hands to his temples as if to quell a headache.
Man, that was intense. He wanted to talk about what happened yesterday, and to say that I should tell Janie's relatives that Vigilant stands ready to help in any way they can.
That's great, I'm sure he'll get an attaboy in his file, but...
He also said he talked to the guy whose car got blown up. He saw your picture on the news this morning.
Hodges isn't surprised, and at this minute doesn't care. Did you get a name? Tell me you got a name.
Not of the IT guy, but I did get the name of the company he works for. It's called Cyber Patrol. People says they drive around in green VW Beetles. He says they're in Sugar Heights all the time and you can't miss them. He's seen a woman and a man driving them, both probably in their 20s. He called the woman kinda dykey.
Hodges has never even considered the idea that Mr. Mercedes might actually be Ms. Mercedes. He supposes it's technically possible and it would make a neat solution for an Agatha Christie novel, but this is real life. Did he say what the guy looked like? Jerome shakes his head. Come on in my study. You can drive the computer while I co-pilot. In less than a minute, they are looking at a rank of 3 green VW Beetles with Cyber Patrol printed on the sides. It's not an independent company, but part of a chain called Discount Electronics with 1 big box store in the city. It's located in the Birch Hill Mall.
Man, I've shopped there, Jerome says. I've shopped there lots of times. Bought video games, computer components, a bunch of Chopsaki DVDs on sale.
Below the photo of the Beatles is a line reading, Meet the Experts. Hodges reaches over Jerome's shoulder and clicks on it. 3 photos appear. 1 is of a narrow-faced girl with dirty blonde hair. Number two is a chubby guy wearing John Lennon specs and looking serious. Number three is a generically handsome fellow with neatly combed brown hair and a bland say-cheese smile. The names beneath are Freddie Linklater, Anthony Frobisher, and Brady Hartsfield.
What now? Jerome asks.
Now we take a ride. I just have to grab something first. Hodges goes into his bedroom and punches the combo of the small safe in the closet. Inside, along with a couple of insurance policies and a few other financial papers, is a rubber-banded stack of laminated cards like the one he currently carries in his wallet. City cops are issued new IDs every 2 years, and each time he got a new one, he stored the old one in here. The crucial difference is that none of the old ones have retired stamped across them in red. He takes out the one that expired in December of 2008, removes his final ID from his wallet, and replaces it with the one from his safe. Of course, flashing it is another crime, State Law 190.25, impersonating a police officer, a Class E felony, punishable by a $25,000 fine, 5 years in jail, or both, but he's far beyond worrying about such things. He tucks his wallet away in his back pocket, starts to close the safe, then rethinks. There's something else in there he might want. A small, flat leather case that looks like the sort of thing a frequent flyer might keep his passport in. This was also his father's. Hodges slips it into his pocket with the happy slapper. 5. After cleansing the stubble on his skull and donning his new plain glass specs, Brady strolls down to the Motel 6 office and pays for another night. Then he returns to his room and unfolds the wheelchair he bought on Wednesday. It was pricey, but what the hell? Money is no longer an issue for him. He puts the explosive-laden ass parking cushion on the seat of the chair, then slits the lining of the pocket on the back and inserts several more blocks of his homemade plastic explosive. Each block has been fitted with a lead azide blasting plug. He gathers the connecting wires together with a metal clip. Their ends are stripped down to the bare copper, and this afternoon he'll braid them into a single master wire. The actual detonator will be Thing 2. One by one he tapes baggies filled with ball bearings beneath the wheelchair's seat using crisscrossings of filament tape to hold them in place. When he's done, he sits on the end of the bed, looking solemnly at his handiwork. He really has no idea if he'll be able to get this rolling bomb into the Mingo Auditorium. But he had no idea if he'd be able to escape from City Center after the deed was done either. That worked out. Maybe this will too. After all, this time he won't have to escape, and that's half the battle. Even if they get wise and try to grab him, the hallway will be crammed with concertgoers and his score will be a lot higher than 8. Out with a bang. Brady thinks. Out with a bang. And fuck you, Detective Hodges. Fuck you very much. He lies down on the bed and thinks about masturbating. Probably he should while he's still got a prick to masturbate with. But before he can even unsnap his Levi's, he's fallen asleep. On the night table beside him stands a framed picture. Frankie smiles from it, holding Sammy the fire truck in his lap. 6. It's nearly 11 a.m. when Hodges and Jerome arrive at Birch Hill Mall. There's plenty of parking, and Jerome pulls his Wrangler into a spot directly in front of Discount Electronics, where all the windows are sporting big sale signs. A teenage girl is sitting on the curb in front of the store, knees together and feet apart, bent studiously over an iPad. A cigarette smolders between the fingers of her left hand. It's only as they approach that Hodges sees there's gray in the teenager's hair. His heart sinks. Holly? Jerome says at the same time Hodges says, what in the hell are you doing here?
I was pretty sure you'd figure it out,
she says, butting her butt and standing up.
But I was starting to worry. I was going to call you if you weren't here by 11:30. I'm taking my Lexapro, Mr. Hodges.
So you said, and I'm glad to hear it. Now answer my question and tell me what you're doing here. Her lips tremble. And although she managed eye contact to begin with, her gaze now sinks to her loafers. Hodges isn't surprised he took her for a teenager at first, because in many ways she still is one.
her growth stunted by insecurities and by the strain of keeping her balance on the emotional high wire she's been walking all her life.
Are you mad at me?